is now in session. The Honorable Daniel R. Foley, Lawrence M. Riker, and Lisa M. Pinoza presiding. Please be seated.
Okay, I would note Mr. McKee for the appellants and no one for the appellees, but we're going to proceed. And we're going to issue an order to show cause to Mr. Taylor to answer why he's not here today. But we certainly don't want to inconvenience you or your client. You're the appellant, so please proceed. The podium is yours.
Case number CAAP-12-582, Keiko Mokiao, claimant appellee, the Attractions Hawaii employer appellant, and Hawaii Employers Mutual Insurance Company insurance carrier appellant. Robert McKee for appellant. No one has appeared for the appellee. Argument on the merits.
Thank you for coming.
May it please the court, we are asking that the court provide their opinion regarding an appeal which we have filed of a Labor and Industrial Relations Appeals Board decision dated May 22, 2012. I've listed in our appeal and our opening brief three points that we'd like the court to address. Point A is whether the appeals board erred in concluding that appellants are liable for the psychiatric injury as a result of or compensable consequence to the May 18th, 2006 right shoulder injury. Point B, whether the appeals board erred in concluding that appellants are liable for medical care, services, and supplies for the psychiatric condition injury. And point C, whether the appeals board erred in concluding that permanent partial disability award should be vacated. With regards to the first point, regarding the determination of compensability as a result of the work injury or compensable consequence of the work injury, I think the first error that we believe the appeals board has made is that they haven't actually determined when the injury became manifest. By not determining when the injury became manifest, it denies my clients the defenses and positions that they may take regarding whether it's still a compensable injury under Chapter 386 of the Hawaii statutes. The evidence showed that based upon Dr. Rogers' psychological opinions and his reports and his testimony at the time of the appeals board trial, that the manifestation was as early as October of 2006. The records are clear that Ms. Mokiao continued working for the employer and then was laid off along with 47 other employees in August of 2008. Then sometime in April of 2009, that's when was the first notice that was given to my clients that she wanted to pursue a psychiatric claim based upon a report provided by Marcia Deaton of the Department of Health. She's a psychologist. Interestingly enough, Dr. Deaton didn't actually keep any records, but she wrote a letter to me in April of 2009 suggesting that Ms. Mokiao came to her because of the layoff.
Counsel, is your argument that the board erred in not going along with Dr. Rogers' date of 2006, or is your argument that the board erred in failing to pick a specific date?
Both, actually. I mean, I think they first need to pick a specific date. If they're going to find that there's an injury, then it started sometime.
So you believe it's error to say sometime between date one and date two, as the board did in this case?
Yes.
Do you have case law that supports that point?
Not specifically that they have to pick a specific date, but I think it would be reasonable for them to do so because there has to be some type of date. There has to be some evidence. If they're going to rely upon Dr. Rogers and Dr. Deaton's opinions that she has a psychiatric injury, then I believe that they are also believing that it started at some point in time.
Don't the dates that the board selects correlate with the date, the first and last dates of the claimant's visits to Dr. Deaton?
Somewhat. We don't actually know when the last date of visit with Dr. Deaton was. We tried to subpoena her records. She didn't keep records. She mentioned in the letter she sent to me she saw Ms. Mokiao four times. Only three dates were mentioned in her letter, so we don't know if the fourth time was in in the end of 2008 after she had her shoulder surgery in Japan, or whether she had, it was sometime in January or February 2009 before there was a hearing to address permanent disability for her shoulder condition.
Am I mistaken? Didn't the letter say that she had last seen the claimant a week earlier?
Well, again, I'm not sure whether that means that was an actual office visit, or is that she came to her and she said, "Would you write a letter to Robert McKee?" Because the letter is addressed to me. So it's not as though she's saying, "Will you submit medical reports and bills to Hawaii Employees Mutual Insurance Company, the Workers' Compensation Insurance Carrier for Attractions Hawaii?" You know, they're writing a letter to me, so I don't know if it was because of a, you know, some kind of a meeting. I wasn't clear about that. So, but I just think, you know, if that was the date of manifestation, then they should have said, you know, if that was generated that opinion or that report, that that was the first time that Ms. Mokiao was told by Dr. Deaton that you have a psychiatric or psychological condition related to your right shoulder injury. Because that would, to us, would be clear that that's when it would be manifest. Then our defenses, our position would fall into place as to when it became manifest.
How would that matter, Mr. McKee? Because the two dates, the initial, I think the LIRAB said somewhere between August of 08 and March of 09. And August of 08 was when your client first started seeing Dr. Deaton. And March of 09 is when Dr. Deaton wrote her letter, right? So that's the dates that the LIRAB picked. How would it matter where within that time period if your client, I mean, not your client, I'm sorry, but Ms. Mokiao's injury manifested during that time? That's all well within the two-year time period, right? How would your argument change?
That is correct. We would not have a defense regarding the statute of limitations for 2 years. However, Ms. Mokiao had shoulder surgery, a right shoulder surgery on November 4th, 2008. Now, if her manifestation of the injury was sometime after that, then if it's as a result or commensal consequence of the right shoulder condition, and the right shoulder surgery has not been found to be the responsibility of my clients, then it's due to a subsequent right shoulder injury slash condition.
So is there any question that the surgery was not related to the 06 work injury?
That's never been addressed by the Department of Labor. That's never been by the Disability Compensation Division. We, one other response to your question is that if it was manifest before we went to a hearing in February of 2009 to address the extent of permanent disability, then we believe that they had the responsibility to file the claim or at least appeal the subsequent March 2009 decision. Because that became a final decision, which indicated that only she had a right shoulder condition, or a right shoulder injury. So I think it does matter that if the injury manifests after the second of three Department of Labor decisions, then our defenses that, you know, we had final decisions would no longer be viable. But as long as it became manifest before we had the hearing in February of 2009, then I think it's. Our position is that they should have come forward and filed it.
Following that thought through, though, isn't there a statute under the workers' comp chapter that you can reopen? You can reopen a claim. It does, you know, regardless of this two-year statute of limitations, once you have a final decision on the presented claim, you can reopen a claim for a period of time thereafter. Why wouldn't that take care of your issue here?
Well, under 38689C, if there's a showing of a change in condition or a substantial change in condition or a mistake in fact, yes, a claimant can reopen the condition. That's actually one of our further arguments regarding medical care. But yes, you know, the claimant can come forward, but at some point the decision has to be final, and the decision that's set forth on two decisions prior to the decision regarding compensability indicated that her injury was only to her right shoulder. You know, it prejudices the employers in the situation that when we see the decision, we make a determination to or not to appeal within 20 days of decision. If the only injury is to the right shoulder, you know, we're stuck with that. You know, they're stuck with that as far as we're concerned, especially when the injury is manifest in the eyes of the appeals board or Dr. Deaton or claimant or claimant's counsel before that decision, before that hearing, before that notice of hearing came out in January 2009. They clearly could have and should have ask that the notice of hearing be changed to include compensability for the psychiatric condition. We so then it would have been manifest before a hearing, before a decision, and then we wouldn't ever have addressed permanent disability for the right shoulder condition.
One follow-up question. If you had been able to appeal this stress claim earlier as a part of that earlier director's decision, the second one, I guess, how would that change? I mean, you are able to challenge the stress claim just in a separate proceeding way. So I'm just trying to understand the prejudice that you claim your client has suffered as a result of allowing Ms. Mokiao to bring her stress claim separately.
Well, I think in every case, if the claimants can then piecemeal with their body parts that they have injured, then we're going to go through the whole gamut of what they're entitled to. We would be addressing temporary disability all over again with regards to her stress claim.
Because each injury claim results in a different TTD, PPD proceeding.
Vocational rehabilitation. So at some point, if a claimant has vocational rehabilitation, and they go back to work, and then they say, well, wait a minute, I think I have another body part I'd like to include. Now, if that body part arose after vocational rehabilitation had ended, or temporary disability had ended, then we wouldn't be prejudiced. But if they're saying it arose before those benefits were addressed at a hearing and a final decision was issued, then I don't think they can continue to come back and open up the claim. They can reopen under 386-89C the same body part. So, for example, if at some point now she needed further medical care for her right shoulder, she could come back and have the doctor submit medical reports that say that we want to treat her, we want to do a second surgery. Now, my clients would have the opportunity to have a medical examination to address whether the need for further medical care was related to this work injury. But she has 8 years to do that. But I don't believe she has 8 years to come back and say, I want additional benefits after there was a final Department of Labor decision for a new injury, especially when that new injury was known to her and her attorney, to Dr. Deaton. Additionally, regarding the manifestation, we believe the court erred as far as, determining that if it was in that time period of August to the end of 2008, August 2008 to the end of 2008, it's based upon Dr. Deaton's opinions that when she came to her because of the layoff from her employment, and she had issues with her layoff from employment, if that's truly the manifestation of when it occurred, then it's as a result of a subsequent intervening injury as a result of the layoff from employment. When Dr. Rogers prepared his opinions after examining her and testified at the time of the appeals board trial, he testified that issue that she had with the layoff had not resolved. So at the very least, what the board should have found is that Ms. Mokia had a subsequent intervening injury as a result of the layoff from her employment. Somewhat getting into our second point of error as far as suggesting or ordering that we're responsible for further medical care as the nature of the injury didn't require, because the evidence clearly shows that she had sustained some type of a psychological problem because of the layoff, which hadn't resolved.
Part of the challenge is that what you're asking us to do is essentially make different fact findings than the LIRAB did. Or am I mistaken in that? And can you, what authority can you cite to us in a similar case or an analogous case where the appellate courts have done something similar as to what you're suggesting?
Well, I guess I don't have any other case law to support that argument, but, the evidence was before the appeals board, and if the appeals board is going to ignore the evidence, that was clear that what Dr. Rogers testified to, then I believe that is an error on their part that should be vacated. In this case, Ms. Mokiao didn't testify. Dr. Deaton didn't testify. We weren't able to get any reports from Dr. Deaton other than a two-page letter that she sent to me. So, it seems like the appeals board is also relying on Dr. Rogers' opinions They haven't discredited him as an expert. They accepted him as an expert in the field of psychological medicine. And, you know, it seems like the reliable probative evidence is that she's, you know, she had a manifestation since October 2006 that she had an aggravation of because of the layoff that hadn't resolved by the time we had the appeals board trial. So, let's see. The other point, as far as determining when the manifestation is, to kind of touch on that one more time, is that she had shoulder surgery November 4th, 2008, in Japan. And we didn't know about this until after she had filed the distress claim. And there was no request, as required by the rules, for her to submit her healthcare providers to submit a treatment plan to the employer for the surgery. There was no opportunity, as allowed by the rules, for the employer to have a second opinion to determine, you know, whether the need for the further medical care, the shoulder surgery, was related to the work injury or some other intervening injury or condition. She just went ahead and had the surgery, and at no time have they requested that we even pay for the surgery. We didn't even know about this until after she filed the distress claim. And now the appeals board references that, and they references Dr. Diamond's opinions, who, after there was an interpretation of the medical records in Japan at the request of Ms. Mookie and my attorney, he prepared an opinion. But there's been no determination, there's been no request. So, you know, if the manifestation of it is as a result of her shoulder condition, then shouldn't there be a determination as to, again, when it was manifest? Because if it was manifest after or as a result of the shoulder surgery on November 4th, 2008, in that time frame, then that would be an unrelated work injury to the May 2006 right shoulder condition.
Okay, so your argument is because the employer did not pay for the surgery in Japan, that treatment is unrelated, or the injury that caused that surgery is unrelated to the compensable injury? Is that essentially what you're arguing?
Essentially, because, I mean, we were first of all, for us to be responsible for it, there has to be a request for a treatment plan submitted in advance of the surgery. At some point, they have to submit a request to us along with medical reports and an invoice to say, please pay for the surgery.
Right, her parents paid for the surgery. She went back to Japan and her parents paid for her surgery, right? So, but that doesn't make it uncompensable. I mean, explain that a little.
Well, it may make it that we're not liable for the medical care fees, but at some point, not until there's a determination, if there's a request that we pay for it, you know, should we have an opportunity to address whether that is compensable? Essentially, arguing then is it's unfair for the appellees to argue on appeal to the Labor and Industrial Relations Appeals Board that there's this treatment she had, it was surgery, it was in Japan, I think it's to the same body part, so, you know, they would be responsible for it. There has been no determination. If we are ever given an opportunity at the Director of Disability Compensation Division level to address this, then we could address that. But yeah, this all comes to our attention only after that she's actually filed the stress claim. So if the appeals board had determined that the manifestation was a result of, or occurred sometime at the end of 2008, and it occurred sometime after the May 4, 2008 right shoulder condition, or sorry, right shoulder surgery, once we go back to the Director of Disability Compensation Division level to address whether we're responsible for that surgery, then and only then would we know if we're responsible for a psychological injury as a result of an injury which occurred at the end of 2008.
Does the presumption of compensability under the workers' compensation statute apply to this stress claim?
Yes.
That's part of the challenge, right, is that, I mean, and going back to the question of evaluating the evidence. I mean, LIRAB, it could have been clearer, perhaps, But isn't there language in their ruling about crediting Dr. Deaton? And I understand your argument about she didn't testify. All we have is this two-page letter from her. And Ms. Mokial didn't even testify. But what's the standard that we should look at the evidence under?
Well, the statute under 386.85 suggests that it has to be substantial evidence to the contrary, that the person wasn't injured at work.
Right.
Now, we believe that that statute, that standard, would apply if there was a request before one of the prior Department of Labor decisions addressing whether she had a permanent disability. If the manifestation occurred before those decisions had occurred, if the manifestation of the stress claim only occurred after a final decision had been issued, then I believe the sole standard would be substantial evidence to the contrary. And how do we do that? Well, we can try to get Dr. Deaton's records. There are none. She saw her as a result of a layoff with Ms. Mokial and 47 other employees at Attractions Hawaii, Sea Life Park. You know, we can try to have an IME done. We can subpoena records. We did that. We had Dr. Rogers, who examined her, who tested her, and gave an opinion as to what her diagnosis were. And he's given an opinion, like, I mean, to my client's only position, that the only credible opinion is that it's, after looking at all the medical records of her shoulder condition, that, you know, she has an aggravation as a result of the layoff. And if it's as a result of the right shoulder condition, then that too, we need to know the manifestation of that. But essentially, I don't believe Dr. Deaton's opinions have any reliable or probative value to the appeals board or this court, because she didn't even perform a psychological examination of Ms. Mokiel. It sounds like she just provided some counseling sessions about her layoff. And at some point in April of 2009, it's likely that what Ms. Mokiel asked, or her attorney asked, can you write a letter to Robert McKee advising that, you know, you've been seeing Ms. Mokiel since the layoff, is essentially what she's done. So I believe the appeals board should have determined that Dr. Rogers' opinions were really the only credible source of any insight as to what was the cause of her condition, or when the cause.
But isn't that a problem for us? I mean, Judge Ginoza asked you before, what's the standard? You know, and one of the standards is standard of review. And generally, when an appellate court looks at findings of an administrative agency or a trial court, when it comes to reliability, credibility, weight, we're not really in a position to second guess it. I mean, isn't that what they're supposed to, I mean, how can, show us how we can do that. How can we can say this witness, albeit by letter as opposed to live testimony, is not credible, although the board found it to be credible and more credible than the other. I mean, how do we do that as an appellate court?
If they're going to set aside Dr. Rogers' opinions and rely upon Dr. Deaton's opinions as to when the condition became manifest, back to one of our initial arguments is that, well, tell us when it became manifest. Tell us how it became manifest. I mean, there has to be some value to Dr. Deaton's opinions to the appeals board. And otherwise, why rely on them? I mean, unless there's some suggestion that she's providing more than just, you know, factual accounting, that I saw her for four visits at some point beginning in August of 2008. Our position is that the board has erred by accepting Dr. Deaton's opinions as any type of guiding light, you know, for their decision. They should have just essentially relied upon the evidence which they had before them, which was essentially Dr. Rogers' reports after his examination and testing and his trial testimony.
Thank you.
The the second point that we've raised on our appeals concerns whether the appeals board had erred in suggesting that Ms. Mokiao is entitled to further medical care for a psychological, psychiatric condition as the nature of the injury may require. And we believe that's an error for the appeals board to do that, as well as the Department of Labor and Disability Compensation to do that, when there's actually no issue actually in dispute. Now, the appeals board did mention that there were no treatment plans in dispute, so I think they should just leave it at that. Because when they suggest that a claimant is entitled to further benefits, it leaves the message that there's no basis for or no requirement that they comply with Chapter 386 going forward as far as the medical care that they might be entitled to. In this particular case, from the time the appeals board issued their pretrial order and our denial of our motion for stay of benefits, Ms. Mokiao was clearly had no obstacles to continue treatment with Dr. Deaton or whoever she wanted to treat up until the appeals board issued their decision. Yet, given the fact that there was a medical record submission deadline, from the date of Dr. Deaton's one letter until the appeals board's medical record submission deadline, there was absolutely no medical evidence from any healthcare provider that she was continuing to treat. So there was no medical documentation that further medical care was needed as a result of this work injury. I believe what the appeals board should set forth is that they should actually remain silent as to, or the director of the Department of Labor and Disability Compensation Division should remain silent, because claimants do have the right to reopen the claim for 8 years from the last payment of benefits if the condition has changed. But it seems like the Department of Labor and Disability Compensation Division and the Appeals Board somehow single out medical care as some type of issue or benefit that they have to remind the parties, you still have a right to benefits. Which, I mean, why do that instead of, you know, for temporary disability or permanent disability or vocational rotation, mileage reimbursement, medication, whatever it may be. You know, they don't do that.
But here, do I understand correctly that your argument is really a prospective one, and that if she argues that she's entitled to proceed outside of 386, then you would say that's illegitimate?
Yes.
But so far as the board having stated it in its order, it's not necessarily error. You're arguing it's perhaps unnecessary?
Correct. Our final point that we've raised is that the board did recognize our denial of due process when it came to the permanent disability award by the Disability Compensation Division and vacated that award. But to be complete as far as our appeal, we wouldn't want the appeals board decision to have, without addressing that point of error, that permanent disability still needs to be addressed by the Disability Compensation Division. So for the reasons we believe, the claims should be found to be non-compensable and that they should not have addressed medical care. We believe that permanent disability should also be found to be not the responsibility of my clients, whether at the appeals board level or at the disability compensation division level. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKee. We'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you very much.